Welcome back to episode 2 in our Summerfest series. I'm Tom Brannigan, and in this episode, I talk to Bob and Scott about how they go about deciding how to put together a Summerfest lineup, who to book based on the festival's legacy of offering a wide variety of music that appeals to all, and why it is so important to not only build, but cultivate and maintain relationships in the industry, and the background behind that, the science of that. Enjoy the show.
How do you decide who to book? So we've got rock, we've got country, we've got other genres. How do you decide? Like, if I'm thinking of a pie chart, mm-hmm. and we have, you know, 5 or 6 different genres, how do you figure out how big each piece of that pie is? Scott?
Well, I think, it's probably different in the amphitheater versus the free stages.
Right.
But, we're basically, obviously, you look at the trades and the charts and who's got the biggest streaming numbers. You also, what we've really done, I think, really effectively in the last, 5, 6, 7 years is you're talking to other concert promoters who have presented a group, how many tickets do they sell, is it taking off, what's the, are they on the rise or are they on the fall, networking, information is key, mm-hmm. basically. There's Miley Cyrus last summer. We basically booked her because we networked with another festival promoter on the West Coast who basically said, pandemic really screwed us up, but we did announce our lineup and then we had to reschedule the whole thing. And we were talking about it. He said, we had some really, really big names, but who came out of the box strongest? It was Miley Cyrus. And we were on the fence. Not really, it's hard to keep up with how everybody is doing in real time, and I don't think we thought that she was as big as she turned out to be, but it was based on that piece of information and then the research that our team did after that that made a really great decision. So
are there other acts you've booked over the years that you were confident in but were surprised at how well they went over?
Billie Eilish.
Who?
Billie Eilish.
Sure.
Because that was just, we had chased it and we had chased it and we had chased it. And when it kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and she had never done anything big yet, And finally the number was pretty big. And then Scott said, we really got to take a shot at this. And I remember laying in bed that night after we made that offer going, oh, Jesus, we could sink the whole freaking company right here if we're wrong. If we made a mistake, we are so deep into it. And then the album came out on a Friday, and by Monday, it was a number one album in the world. And we said, okay, well, this is going to work out fine. And then the wow. next weekend, we put it on sale, and we sold it all in a half hour. And it was the biggest show she'd ever done. I mean, she was, at that time, she wasn't even ready production-wise. When they first came to us and they said, well, can we bring us our own little stage? And it was like a little floating stage. And we said, oh, sure. And they said, well, how much time do we have set up? We said, you have all day. You're kidding me. I said, no, this isn't a festival like you're thinking about it. You get 10 minutes to set up. You've got all day to set it up. You just tell us what you need, sound lights and everything. Sure. And then the best part of that was she got on stage and she said, I was sitting upstairs by this window by the dressing room with my grandma, and I see all these people pouring into this place, and I realized they're all coming to see me. She said, that was a moment.
What a feeling.
Yeah.
Any other shows you were surprised that?
That did as
the
well
amount of traction
that
they got?
Surprised us? Well, that one just comes out of nowhere so fast. There are bands that have played, the rock stage in the old days that got big all of a sudden. That got bigger later. Bon Jovi played the rock stage. He emptied his own van of gear. Remember mm-hmm. that? And REM came out that way. A bunch of people broken through that way. Yeah. But I can't think of somebody that really jumped out. Can you think of something that surprised us?
There's always...
What we put in the Miller area after we...
Oh, Imagine Dragons.
Imagine Dragons, that surprise. That kept building at the last minute.
that was, I mean, basically they should have played the amphitheater that year, and we were booked. And
it was booked already. Wiz Khalifa the first time, right?
This is just shows you like how, I mean, adults don't understand social media or technology. We booked this guy, Wiz Khalifa, right? Rapper
guy.
Who's coming this year. The three W's. Wayne, Wiz, and Wu. We just confirmed them and announced them. Mm-hmm. But so we book them on the Harley
this
Davidson
is 10 years
stage.
Ago, okay.
Yep. And we didn't. At the time it was like, I would say that we're very particular about that. You know, that style of music. We don't want guys that have, you know, drug problems or, you know, carrying guns and all the stuff that kind of goes with the baggage that goes along with that style of music. So we're very particular. So we get Wiz, we're excited. He's a cool guy. And so like a day or two before the show's going to happen, it's on a Tuesday, I'm in our production office, and Dominique, who is like our young go-getter, production office worker, she was like talking about Facebook, and Facebook had only been out for, you know, a year or two, or people getting to use it and doing events and stuff like that. And I didn't really understand Facebook. And she's like, you know, there's going to be a lot of people here for Wiz Khalifa. And I said, well, why do you say that? She's like, well, here, let me show you. And she's like, okay, so what you can do is you basically have all your friends, and you can create events, and you can invite them, and then you can see how many people come in. And I was like, wow, this is cool. And then she goes, well, here, look, there's 26,000 people who say they're coming to Summerfest to see Wiz Khalifa on a free stage. It's like an amphitheater show. And sure enough.
So she had been monitoring that, and you hadn't been because it was new and not part of the routine yet.
Since we've gotten really good at the metrics of an act from the time that you want to book them and trying to catch them at that right time. So that's, you know, they're on the upswing, that you can book somebody in January, and by June, July, they could be really big. Mm-hmm. We also do it just from a crowd control standpoint too, where it's like we booked Imagine Dragons. They drew a really big crowd. Fortunately, we had come up with a plan where when we have so many people on the grounds that we don't have all of the artists finish their sets at the same time, where everybody wants to leave, because that's really a problem.
So you're staggering the slots so you don't have a mass exodus out the doors.
And we're kind of doing it in real time too. It's right. Like where it's like something might... there are some nights where you're like, wow, this is going to be crazy, and then everything is fine, you know. And then there's other times where it kind of builds, and all of a sudden we're on the phone and we're working with our security people. And then sometimes it's calling up a tour manager and saying, I really, really need you to be the early set. So you start at 10 o'clock. I need you to finish at 11:15. And then you call the other artist and say, I need you to do three or four more songs and stay on stage and keep your crowd in the area longer, and then it kind of breaks things up.
Well, this is important context to Bob's comment a little while ago about we only see two or three songs and then we're off. This is the kind of stuff you're doing during Summerfest behind the scenes. You're actually managing the logistics and the flow of all these different shows, because there's security issues and all these things that the average goer isn't even thinking about.
Right.
Yeah. When you're talking about, you threw out some numbers here, you know, when you're looking at a quarter million, half a million, three quarters of a million, $1 million for a band, that's a significant amount of financial exposure that you're committing to. So how much autonomy do you have to make these decisions? Is it...
Actually.
Like, so when you're talking about $1 million offer, is it a group decision? Can you just do that on your own?
Actually, there's a trust involved. We'll show Mr. Smiley, and he's the only person that really looks at what our deals are going to be. And we say, you got to trust us. You got to trust us. We've been doing it a long time. We've been wrong. We've been right more than we've been wrong.
What's your hit rate? What percent?
75. 75, 78, something like that. Yeah.
I mean, I think also, yeah. I always, the numbers are the numbers. They're crucial. They're very important to running this business. But I also feel like if we are presenting artists that maybe don't hit a number that we want, that as long as they're putting on an amazing show, people who are here that have bought tickets have a great experience. You know, if we sell 10,000 seats in a 23,000 seat amphitheater, that's not preferred. But if our customers walk away and happy and talking about things, they walk away talking about the experience. They generally aren't talking about like that they're, you know, that there weren't, it was only half hours.
And as
whatever.
Randy McIlworth always said, they're not bad, no bad shows, just bad deals.
Bad deals.
There you go. Well, and there's something to be said. I mean, Scott, what you just mentioned is more intangible, but there's also something to be said for, hey, we took a shot in a genre we haven't had on stage and it went over well. So we're showing our client base, Summerfest goers, that we're appealing to different people from different backgrounds and cultures and that kind of thing. So there's an intangible there. If you have a hit with a show, but maybe it isn't as much as you thought it would be, you're still exploring other avenues.
Right. And there are paid sites we subscribe to that'll tell us ticket sales for an act that's come through this market. That same act has been through the market 2, 3, 4 times. We can see how it's done, how it's grown. And then you can hear from the other side when you're talking to somebody in the music business or the record side that says this, or the agent or manager says this new album is really good. Machine Gun Kelly.
Yeah.
You know, he came through last time, did great, came through the time before that, did fairly well, and then everybody talked about how great this new album was with Travis Barker and everything, so we bet on that, and that's like selling great for us.
Sure. Can we think of a major performer, so let's say Rush, when Rush came through. Can you take us through the process of booking a major band like that? How does it start?
Sure. It one of two ways. Either we're going out and saying, we hear somewhere through the grapevine that Rush may tour this year, may not go to Europe. Europe's our main competition, right? I mean,
and your grapevine are these relationships that we talked about earlier.
Yeah, the years, right? If they're going to go to Europe, any band that's going to go to Europe for the summer starts with Glastonbury, which is usually like the first week in the Summerfest, like it is this year. And then they stay there for the run of the summer, so we can't get those acts. If they're going to stay in the States, then we hear from agents or managers that they're planning on touring. Do we have an interest in putting an offer in? Or we may be just doing one of our fishing expeditions and say, here's what we think this band is worth. Here's an offer for you. Do you have an interest in starting a tour with us?
Okay.
And we've had some relationships. Tom Petty's perfect, where Tom's manager would call us and say, we're going to go out this summer. You can be an anchor date. Do you want us back? So, and you know, it's always a resounding yes, and we just had to figure out ticket prices, et cetera. But so it goes both ways. Either we're out there fishing out on it, or somebody's bringing artists to us. And then the artist has to decide, real quick, do we want to play a festival? Do we want to play indoors at Pfizer? Because that's where we'll design our set. We don't want to have an outdoor set. Do we want to play amphitheaters? Because then you can go play Alpine Valley if we think that we can do 35,000 people or 40,000 people compared to what our building holds. Or do you decide you want to play a stadium? And there are some acts that, even though their show can fit in our building, they are going to play a stadium because they want to say, we play just stadiums. So.
How long, once there's interest on both ends, typically, what's the life cycle of getting a deal done? How long does that take?
Sometimes 2-3 months, sometimes 4-5 months, sometimes 4-5 weeks.
Okay.
It's different.
So,
it's different. It's all different. If you get an artist that has an interest in doing something, it happens sometimes pretty quick.
Scott, when we're talking about these top tier acts, is there any one thing that kills a deal? Is there anything when you're negotiating these that you're in the back of your head, you're like, this has happened enough, I hope it doesn't happen this time?
I don't know if there's one. I don't know if there's one thing. I mean, you're like Bob saying, you're trying to sell what makes your venue the best or special, right? So, I mean, I've watched Bob take artists that clearly could go play a baseball stadium or a football stadium for 40, sure. 50, or 60,000 people and bring them to our building at 23,000 by selling all of the things that make us special. I mean, that you're still going to have, you're going to sell enough seats that you're going to, you know, you're going to, I mean, one of the things that Bob always talks about, which is true, it's like if you go to play a ballpark, it costs, what, about $1 million?
$1 million to put up a stage.
So that's
we redesigned our building so you can put a stadium show in our building.
So let me just, I want to make sure that we're understanding this. Sure. So if you're going to play a ballpark, that's $1 million ante. Like, that's $1 million investment, period.
And we
put up the stage.
And we have none of those expenses here because now we have, the roof is high enough that you can hang the whole show. So basically, it's like it's starting with $1 million less in expenses. So then you sell all the other things, right? You sell that we're a concert, but we're also a concert within a music festival, and that this is something that our patrons look forward to once a year. It's this big spring awakening. You know, I remember over time watching, you know, like, as you know, watching and learning from Bob on the amphitheater side, like a lot of the tours that would come here and be included, you know, the amphitheater had some of the highest grosses compared to other markets, and I think it's because of the fact that it's a special place, cool building on the lake, tied in with the festival. There's
downtown Milwaukee.
Lots more hype and than just being a concert at a ballpark. So those are the things to answer your question. I mean, you have to kind of, you know, sell what makes this special and different, and then you hope that that's.
And one of the main selling points of the event is that it's a Milwaukee People's Festival. And we talk about how when we announce lineups, people are talking about not just it's a festival, it's our festival, it's our Summerfest. Let's see what our Summerfest lineup is like. What's our lineup look like this year? And you hear people talking about that out in the city. What's our lineup look like this year? Because we want them to be a part of the festival, and that's what sells a lot of times to the major acts, is that they're going to be in downtown Milwaukee at an event where people are there to see you at their festival.
I think this is a very important part of the Summerfest legacy, in that the organization has connected with this community in really meaningful ways over the years. Part of it is outreach and supporting of the community, of course, but also part of it is the care that Summerfest puts into making this a real experience for people. Like, Summerfest doesn't commoditize Milwaukee. We're in this community, we live in this community, we shop in this community, we want to make this the best festival possible, starting with this community. And do you think that there's something about that resonates with agents, or is it like, how cutthroat is it? I mean, is there something about that? Because Scott, you actually anticipated my next question that I was going to ask. What are the two or three things that factor the most into closing deals? And I think that you covered that really well. But do you think that weighs in at all, or is it pure numbers, pure bottom line?
It all depends who you're talking to. I mean, if it's a lot of times the agents, it's just bottom line, right? But a lot of the managers sit with their artists and say, you know, you can always go play a more expensive ticket. You can go downtown and play a more expensive ticket at the Milwaukee Theater or whatever, or you can come down to Summerfest and play where it's $25 or free, and you're going to have 12,000 rabid fans that are going after you. Now, you can't do that every other year or every year, because you're going to lose the hard ticket environment, right? But
right.
You can come down there and build that brand for you, and then come back the next year and go play indoors and make the money that way. Dave Matthews is very smart in that Dave Matthews plays our place every other year and goes to Alpine every other year. Mm. And because he's got a group of fans that love Alpine Valley. People that go to Alpine, you know, they're a group that love to go to Alpine Valley. They love the aspect of camping, about it being mostly lawn. They just like the vibe. Dave, Jimmy Buffett's crowd, same kind of thing. But Dave's people want to do their 2 days down there or their 3 days down there 1 year, and the next day they'll play with us. The next year they'll play for us in Northerly Island. Then they'll go back into Alpine again. He goes back and forth, so he keeps his audience happy and he keeps it fresh.
So let's stay on Dave Matthews for a minute. So you have a big ticket act like that. Take us through their experience when they get here. They show up at a certain time, they do a sound check. Where do they go after that? When do they show up? Is there a separate entrance? How does security work?
Sure.
What is that?
The amphitheater has an entrance underneath the walkways. So there's a road that goes back there and the artists can come in that way. Two different kinds of touring people. There are people that love buses, and there are people that will, big acts that'll sit in one city and then fly from city to city, right? Like if you take Tom Petty in the old days, or bands at that level, they'll stay in Chicago, and the artists will stay in Chicago, and their families will stay at the same hotel, and they'll go to the airport and take the jets up to Milwaukee, and then after the show, they'll fly back to Chicago. The next day, they'll fly to St. Louis, come back to Chicago. The next day, Minneapolis. They'll keep a hub like that, and then the crew guys will all travel in buses everywhere around the country. Other groups like Country Guys, they just love buses. They all come together, the band, the crew, and everybody shows up at the same time and comes backstage, and it becomes just a big day for everybody. Mm-hmm. We have 9 loading bins behind the amphitheater, so you can load 9 trucks at one time. We've got 19 dressing rooms, so there's plenty of space up there for everybody. And then we've got room for maybe parking, I don't know, 10, 15 buses outside too. So it all depends how it's going to work, but the normal crew shows up. They bring everything. We have a sound and lighting system if they want it, but out of 9 days, 7 of them will bring their own stuff because they're touring with their own gear in the semis full. And they'll show up, the first guys will show up about 6 a.m. and they'll hang their rigging points in the ceiling and their chain motors and everything else. Then they'll unload, put everything up, have breakfast, continue, have lunch, continue, and then they get ready for about a sound check sometime around 2:30, 3, and then there'll be a sound check. Half the time the band doesn't do sound checks anymore. The road guys, the guitar tech, the drum tech, and everybody else does the sound checks for them. But by that time, a lot of the bands are showing up already, except the guys that are flying in. And then they'll do the show, and then the bands will take off right away and either going back to the airport or get on their own separate buses and leave. And then the crew has everything down within 3 hours. And they'll be out of here by 12:30, 1 o'clock. And then our guys get some sleep and turn around and do it again. Clean a building and turn around and do it again the next day.
So
it's
the
pretty
band,
crazy.
So the bands often don't do their own sound checks. I would think the first thing I thought of is like monitor mixes and things like that. Is that just all pre-programmed pretty much?
Well, now it's all digital. So they'll just bring a disc and throw it in because they've been in the building before, if you will. But the road guys know the sound that the band wants. I mean, they can all play, right? They're great drummers and they're great guitar players, the road guys. And they'll get up there and they'll sing songs and sing the harmonies because they know how their lead guys want it to sound. Now, some bands will still go in and do it. The Stones did a sound check, you know? I mean, and those guys hung around all day. They came in the morning and they just hung out. That's what they do. I think they're old school guys. They just kind of hang out.
Thanks for listening. Join us again for episode 3 in our Summerfest series, where Bob Babish discusses the reasons behind his decision to retire, how his work has changed over the years, and more.